Kia ora na koutou, Bobongi Mania. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We acknowledge that our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Matora I te arawe I a koe, ko toku I ngoa Agi Tupou. And on the show today, concerns over US President Trump's latest travel bans in the Pacific region. In a first, a Tongan woman wins the right to live in New Zealand due to fear of persecution being a lesbian. And a first international-led cleanup of World War II bombs in Papua New Guinea. More on those stories shortly, but I say me taki ma'ata. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with a senior Pacific academic who is warning that the US will lose its influence in the region if it goes ahead with a proposal to issue travel bans against 36 countries, some from the Pacific. Tonga, Vanuatu and Tuvalu were named in a leaked internal document published by the Washington Post newspaper. As Whenau Whenua reports, the concerns over a travel ban come as authorities crack down on anti-Trump protests across the United States.
The Trump administration is considering broadening its multi-country travel ban. Sources say Secretary of State Marco Rubio told diplomats in a memo that the countries listed were given 60 days to meet various benchmarks or get banned.
Reports that 36 countries are being reviewed for travel restrictions in the U.S. come as mass protests continue to grow across the country. Among the nations being considered are Vanuatu, Tonga, and Tuvalu. According to a memo leaked to the Washington Post newspaper, the countries listed failed to meet established requirements, such as having a competent central government, a failure to accept deported citizens, and having a high number of overstayers.
Today, there are millions and millions of these illegals who should not be in our country.
President Donald Trump said it was common sense restrictions that would protect Americans from dangerous foreign actors. For certain minorities in the U.S., however, such as the sizable Tongan diaspora, it's causing anxiety, especially when Trump's proposal includes ending birthright citizenships.
It's heartbreaking. I really think that's the only way you can put it.
Stephanie Mahina is an American of Tongan descent who works as a radio host for a local station in Salt Lake City, Utah. The state is known for its large Tongan diaspora, with the tight-knit community taking pride in its NFL players and high military enlistments. But Stephanie told ABC's Nija Daily that many are feeling alienated and are anxious.
You will be deported straight home with no accessibility back here. My partner, being of Tongan descent but living in New Zealand, he's afraid to travel here right now because he's scared he'll get stopped in the airport and deported back to Tonga and not to New Zealand.
That anxiety has been exacerbated following the death of a Samoan American man at an O'King's march in Salt Lake City over the weekend. Afa'alu was a bystander fatally wounded during a shooting between event security and a suspicious gunman. Stephanie says many islanders stayed away from the march out of fear they would be profiled by immigration officials.
I have talked to a lot of family members, like my own cousins that are here right now, and they're very much in fear for their lives. They're terrified that ISIL come knocking on their door. I know a lot of people are genuinely just terrified to go out into public spaces. A lot of the families that are protesting and the people that are at protest are not Tongans. They're not the ones that are saying no kings. They're not the ones that are even in a public eye because they're afraid.
In Tonga, there's disappointment in the U.S., a country long considered to be a big brother. Tonga's Prime Minister Isaac Eke only earlier this year expressed concern about Tonga's capacity to cope with larger numbers of deportees arriving from the U.S. Malakai Koloa Matangia, professor at the Tonga National University, says Trump's new policies are undermining America's influence.
For Tonga, it'll make it more difficult, and I just think it is a discriminatory move. This is actually a disengagement.
Australia National University Professor Henrietta McNeil agrees. She says the reputation of the U.S. as a reliable partner is being tarnished.
We've definitely seen U.S. influence in the Pacific Islands decrease under the Trump administration with the lack of U.S. aid, with now these decisions around migration. I think that there is deep concerns about how the Pacific will view the US, which only really came back into the region in the last couple of years anyway, and really put a big effort into being part of the region and maintaining that influence. But I think it will look very short term now that US influence is really waning. And I think that has significant implications for geopolitics.
The economic fallout of travel restrictions are also expected to be significant. The Tongan and Ni Vanuatu diaspora in the US contributes heavily to tourism in their countries of heritage.
We know that remittance is a huge part, particularly of the Tongan and the Vanuatu economies. We know that often money travels back when people travel back and for important events to celebrate ceremonies. And so if people are unable to travel for those types of ceremonies, it may be less likely to come.
And that is Australian National University scholar Henrietta McNeil ending that package from Whenau Whanua. Now, growth in the Pacific has slowed, inflation has fallen, and the female workforce is being underutilised. Those are the key findings of the World Bank's latest economic update. The semi-annual update focused on 11 countries, which includes Fiji, Solomon Islands, Palau, Vanuatu, Tonga, Samoa, Marshall Islands, Nauru, Micronesia, Tuvalu and Kiribati. The report noted that growth in the Pacific has slowed down from 5.5% in 2023 to 3.8% in 2024. Ekaterina Vashakmadze, a senior economist with the World Bank, told Lucy Cooper that this slowed growth was forecasted.
The first contributor to slow of growth in the region is that this huge boost from post-pandemic, extraordinary, strong, although delayed recovery, has finally and little by little gradually dissipated. That's why growth gradually slows. And for inflation, the hike in inflation was fed and driven by high commodity prices, specifically the energy prices, which surged post-pandemic. And that also this contributor to high inflation has also dissipated. Now, what is different is the following, especially on growth. The more challenging global environment, which also we anticipated, but all in the risks. It was not part of our baseline, now is materializing. And that's why you can see that we have downgraded our growth, right, compared to the previous publication.
How can we turn this around?
There are two things. So one is that because the world is very, as we know, right, there's high uncertainty, and it has been for last decades, this high uncertainty, shock after shock faced by the countries. One thing which we clearly learned is that building resilience is essential, and it has many elements. And this is actually related to the second part I want to talk about. So how to build resilience? On one hand, we clearly need to increase resilience of the government to be able to cope and to address the shocks, which means fiscal savings, if we say in simple words. But the other one is more resilience of households, right? If every human being, every person, every household is more resilient, then economy collectively and businesses are more resilient, which means investing in human capital and which means employing more female where you have big potential.
And now Ralph Van Dorn, the lead economist for the World Bank in the Pacific region, told Lucy Cooper that each country is affected differently by recent US tariffs, which has seen the world enter a time of global trade policy uncertainty.
Pacific Islands all have a different exposure to trade. Now, what we are looking at the moment is we don't have any advanced knowledge of what's going to happen. So we are trying to deal with this uncertainty in our kind of economic outlooks by looking at different scenarios. And we published one just last week in our World Bank Global Economic Prospects report. And there we have what we call baseline, which is the most we consider to be kind of the reference scenario, and also a high and a low case scenario to understand better what happens if different scenarios materialize. So under the baseline scenario, in which we project that the global economy is going to grow at 2.3%, we assume there that the tariffs as they are in place now will continue for the next few years. Now, we also have two other scenarios. One is a what we call low-case scenario, which is if the tariffs are increased, and that could lead to a possible response for other countries. And that, you know, and that will lead to perhaps to an impact on trade and growth that will have a more negative impact on global growth. We also have a positive scenario. What if in a few weeks or months from now, the tariffs are reduced to what they were before? And that would lead to a, we expect a higher growth and more trade.
Reading through this report, it says, you know, the increase in trade policy restrictions and the fragmentation of trade and investment networks have the potential to cause a rebound in inflation. So is this kind of acknowledging that these tariffs out of the US are having a profound impact on Pacific growth?
In our projections, the longer term trends that we've looked at are the post-pandemic recovery and the lowering of inflation after towards the tail end of the pandemic. We saw a very large increase in inflation globally, also in commodity prices due to geopolitical tension that happened elsewhere. Those are the main drivers of our growth projections, the normalization of growth at a lower rate in the Pacific, and also the normalization of inflation in the Pacific. So those are the major drivers that we see for now, based on various shocks that have happened. We have also adjusted the growth rate projections that partially reflects trade uncertainty, but also country-specific shocks. For example, the earthquake that hit Vanuatu back in December. So those have also been taken into account. And then we look at what's the aggregate impact. And that's really what we are showing in our report. What has been the impact of all this on our projections for both growth and inflation?
And that there is Ralph Van Doorn, the lead economist for the World Bank of the Pacific, speaking with Lucy Cooper.
Pacific Beat.
Tagia Tumas, thank you for joining us here on Pacific Beat. Now, close to 2,000 bombs from World War II have been cleared from Papua New Guinea following a 10-day operation in East New Brighton. A task force made up of soldiers from Australia, PNG, Japan, the US, France and Canada spent 11 days in danger zones around Rabaul and Kokobo. It is one of the first international-led cleanup efforts since the end of the conflict. And the operation comes after a 1,000-pound torpedo was found in the province in 2023 that East New Britain Governor Michael Murram personally detonated.
They invited me to go and press the button, what do you call it? Yeah, just to
detonate it.
Yeah. So I was a bit scared, but we had to evacuate the entire four villages around them. Out by, 5-10 kilometers. Yeah, so this was a big explosion, that operation. So then after that, and I thought to myself, there could be more. That's where I opted to seek assistance from the Japanese government, especially, and Australian government.
And was the operation a success?
Yes, it was so successful. 2 days ago, the numbers we had was 1,800 old bombs, various sizes.
Wow.
And according to the commander, the commander that led the team was Commander Major Joseph Gurung. Those were the numbers when we had a brief. Yeah, so I briefly advised that I'm going to seek extension again of the operation and also see if they can come back again, because we believe there's still more out here. You know, there's some that they identified, but they couldn't remove them.
And I understand that this operation was strictly surveying. So it was about locating these bombs and recording them so they can then dispose of them at a later date. Is there any word on what will happen to them now? Like, will the troops come back and dispose of them, or will that fall to the PNG Defence Force?
There was a timeline for them to come back and then dispose, because it's in big numbers. And the problem we had was this, we need, currently they're stockpiling it now. And again, it's not safe for putting everything in one shed. So there could be an operation earlier for disposal within PNG Defence Force. What they mentioned to me was they were going to provide a detailed report of everything and when the timelines of when they were going to come back and dispose, or if they were going to do it, or PNG Defence Force. But our PNG Defence Force, I think they can probably do it as well. So, and the concerning thing for us now is, you know, how long do we keep them for? We have to put an eye out on everything that's locked up. And yeah, it's not safe.
Yeah, so these bombs are just currently all stored in a shed now, are they?
That's correct, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I can certainly understand why that would be a concern. And was this the first time that Operation Render Safe, or I suppose any international forces in general, had come to East New Britain to help out with this sort of work?
Yeah, I believe it's the first time that, joint forces coming together and come to East New Britain especially. I think they've done a minor operation in probably 2015 with only Australian PNG. And so this is the first time for actually all of them, the experts and everything else. So they come in the big C-120s and bring all the equipment in. And, yeah, so they're professionals and they do all this all over the Pacific, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, they obviously Render Safe, the program itself, has spent a lot of time in the Solomon Islands, I know that. And I guess, yeah, I've always just wondered, given how much fighting took place in PNG, particularly around Rubao, why it has taken so long for them to arrive. But I imagine it must be great that they're finally here.
Yeah, no, that was why I thought I could seek assistance from both governments especially. And it was good to see a couple of Japanese soldiers among them as well. So they had the opportunity to go and have a look at the old caves where, you know, stuff were kept and locked away, and hopefully they get back here in future.
How has all that unexploded ordnance from that era impacted the lives of people in East New Britain in the time since? Has it always been an ongoing danger?
It is. When you go around, there's people walking around with some parts of their body missing, and then you find out they've been at the garden, or the making, there was a fire without knowing there was a bomb underneath, and then it exploded, or someone could have been picking up a bomb and trying to cut it open, get the grease for dynamite or stuff like that. So, and especially where the fighting zones were, you know, people couldn't go out to properly they make the gardens or grow their vegetables, so because they're scared there could be something there, or sometimes they just don't know, and you never know what's going to happen next. So, yeah.
And that's East New Britain Governor Michael Merrim speaking with Carl Evans. Stay tuned as we head into your headlines from around the region. Kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, it's that time we head around the region, get our news wrap and our headlines from producer Carl Evans, who's in studio with me this morning. Good morning, sir. How you doing?
Good morning. I'm well, Aggie. Yeah. It was my father-in-law's birthday last night. And
Did you spoil him?
We did. We took him out to dinner and I got to show him my favourite cuisine, which is actually Turkish food.
Oh, all right.
I don't think he enjoyed it too much, but I enjoyed it immensely. Had a nice glass of red wine and slept beautifully.
Go. Nice. Well, I'm glad you're in studio this morning. As we kick into our stories from around the region, we start off in the Cook Islands, though. I believe the authorities are on edge following an uptick of gang members with Cook Islands Heritage entering the country. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So they say there's been an increase in known gang members coming into the Cook Islands, coming mainly from New Zealand and Australia. So that's according to the Cook Islands News and Police Media, who are reporting organised gangs are increasing their mobility right across the Pacific, and the Cooks are just the latest victim of that. With that obviously comes the risk of increased criminal activity, but there's another factor which is worrying authorities out in the Cooks, and that's the influence they are having on the local youth population.
Wow. Okay, Kyle, what kind of influence are they having then?
So it's mainly on social media, Aggie. People connected with these gangs, they post a lot of videos to Instagram, TikTok, places like that, really glorifying the lifestyle. And unfortunately, young people, they engage with it. They connect to it, in some cases aspire to it in a lot of ways. And police say, unfortunately, it's often youth sent from New Zealand or Australia who, you know, they come from broken homes, that they get sent back to the islands that sort of, you know, tend to get caught caught up the most and seduced by the lifestyle. And there's not a lot authorities can do about it. Youth engagement programs exist, but they're quite limited within the Cook Islands. And on the flip side, it's not like they can keep gang-affiliated people out because due to their local heritage, obviously they can come and go as they please, provided that they're complying with the laws. So, yeah, it's an interesting one.
That will be an interesting story. I think that's something that we should sort of follow up and see if we can get someone to talk about that. Look, in Samoa, though, I believe there's concern. People aren't registering to vote in the upcoming election as quickly as they should.
Yeah, that's right. So more than 39,000 eligible voters across Samoa remain unregistered, with a deadline fast approaching. So that's according to the latest data released by the Office of the Electoral Commissioner, which states as of this week, only 67% of the eligible voters had completed the mandatory voter re-registration. So in real terms, 78,000 out of 117,000 people, or registered voters, I should say, are currently registered in Samoa. The good news is that number is trending up, albeit very, very slowly. As of June 13, 66% had registered. So it's gone up 1 percentage point in the last few days. However, it's going to want to start rising a lot faster to ensure everyone gets enrolled, because that deadline to register is July 4. So not a lot of time left.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, guys, for those who need to be registering, get registered. Finally, we go to sport. This news where Ari Savio is about to take a break from Wana Pasifika.
Yeah, I blinked when I read this one this morning, I got to say. Ari Savio will skip Super Rugby with Moana Pacifica next year to take a sabbatical in Japan, according to reports. So, look, obviously quite sad news for Moana fans. Confusing as well, given that he signed a 3-year contract. That's how long I thought many people would assumed he would be staying. Turns out, though, his contract included a clause, called a sabbatical clause, which he's decided to exercise, which has effectively ruled him out of the Super Rugby season next year.
Okay, with that sabbatical course, though, I just need to quickly ask, does that mean he is coming back?
Not for next year. Yes, likely that he'll come back the year after.
Right.
But the sabbatical basically means, basically like a break, essentially. It's just like, I've done 1 year. I'm going to take a break now, and then I'll come back and see out the rest of the contract afterwards.
Wow. Well, how have the fans reacted, though?
From what I can see online, it's a bit of a mix. Partly sadness, partly gratitude, obviously, for what he's done for the club, but a little bit of bemusement as well. Last year, obviously, was their most successful season with him as their leader at the helm. They finished only one game out from finals. But now with his absence, many are doubting whether they'll even be competitive next season. And that, coupled with the fact that they've obviously just let another 15 players go, some are speculating, well, you know, is he fleeing a sinking ship, which is obviously not good. Not good for morale. I hope for the best for Moana. I really do. And let's hope he can get back to New Zealand soon.
Well, always considered the underdogs, right? And so we're really rooting for them. So let's see how they go. Yeah, continuing on from there. But as always, Malo Bidakar for bringing us the news wrap here on Pacific Beat. Well, a Tongan woman has been granted the right to remain in New Zealand after the refugee tribunal found she would face persecution in Tonga because of her sexual orientation as a lesbian. She's currently recognised as a refugee under the tribunal, as qualified for protection due to the danger she may face in her home country. Now, Tonga is among several Pacific countries where same-sex relationships are outlawed and can carry jail time. For privacy reasons, we cannot reveal her identity, but to delve into the situation more, we're joined now by co-founder and executive director of the Tonga Ladies Association, the only LGBTQI organisation in Tonga, Joey Jolene Mataele. With that, I say malo tama upongpongini. Welcome to the show, Joey.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be back on Radio ABC again and the Pacific Beat.
Thank you. Thank you really for your time this morning. Joey, I mean, first off, what was your reaction to this latest news from New Zealand?
My reaction is good on her. You know, I'm so happy that she's granted that refugee permit. And, it's whoever can, this is not the first time really for anyone from Tonga, from the LGBTIQ, to seek refuge in Australia or New Zealand, because a lot, you know, we may be to the world with, you know, we're so accepting and all that, but when it comes to personal choices, you know, a lot of families are not very open about the sexuality of their children or, you know, their families. You know, and especially when it comes to lesbians, you know, gays and trans communities are so open. But when it comes to lesbians, it's such a very delicate issue or a topic, eh?
So then, am I hearing, Joey, that you agree with the New Zealand Tribunal's finding? Because out of that, you know, is she saying that, yes, there is persecution of people based on their sexual orientation?
Well, it really depends from which family that she comes from, but at the same time, at the you know, in our laws, it's still, it, you know, it, the law, the homosexuality law in Tonga still exists, and if New Zealand can give her the, you know, the freedom to, you know, to live and be protected, I believe she deserves every bit of it. And I think she deserves a better life. And if it's happened to be in New Zealand, then by all means, you know, I don't know, but with me personally, I give her all the credit. And if I was ever able to, if it needs a letter of clarification or anything, you know, from our organization to support her, I would definitely do it, you know. And it's not because we support her, you know, whatever thing, but it's to support her to live a better life, you know, because lesbians are still very much a delicate issue in Tonga, because a lot of them are still in the closet and, you know, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, let's talk about that, because, you know, we understand that civil unions are prohibited in Tonga, right? So do you then say others in the kingdom are also maybe fearful of coming out in the fact that they could also be persecuted?
But very much. I mean, they might not be persecuted by the law, but, you know, because even though the law is there, is in place, but there hasn't been any case of same-sex consensual relationship that has been persecuted. You know, not. But the problem is, a lot of them are being persecuted by the families. They're because of the, I don't know, it's about what people as, you know, see, and they are, for our families, because of the culture and religion that we're so bombarded with, we, you know, we get so, I don't know. Somehow I feel that we mix culture and religion together and it becomes a chaos. You know, before Christianity came to our shores, we had our culture and there was no labeling, no marginalization. And there was only status, king, nobles and commoners. There was nothing else, you know, and until that, you know, Christianity came. Nothing against Christianity. I love my Christian life. I still, you know, I'm a devoted Catholic, you know, because I come from a founding families of two churches, of two religions, the Mormon, the LDS, and the Catholic Church. But, you know, I live to believe that the Bible is there to support us, to teach us to love, and not labeling and putting anyone down, no matter what color they are, no matter what sexual orientation, gender identity they are, you know, everybody has got a right to live and a right to life.
Mm. And this is the thing, though, you know, with a deeply Christian nation as Tonga, what then has, or have you heard what the reaction has been like in Tonga on this story?
Well, to be honest, I haven't really heard anything at all. There hasn't been any, apart from the Kaniva posting, you know, I haven't really heard anything back at home about, even from our own community, you know, from our LGBT community in Tonga, yes. Nothing has come up, you know, because maybe if it was happening in Tonga, then it will be kind of, but it's really, I mean, to be very honest, Agnes, and you know, our biggest cyberbullying, it comes from Tongans that lives overseas, you know, and it's ridiculous, you know, and these are people, when I even go into their pages, and these are people who, oh my gosh, if we have to list out things that they've done in their life, you know, in their lives, the whole church will collapse, you know. And oh my gosh, it, you know, the hypocrisy and you know, and people just pretending, you know, they have to have a saying, you know, that thinks that they have the right to put down anybody just because of their sexual orientation and, you know, and gender identity,
yeah,
or sexual characteristics, you know, it's pathetic, you know, and, you know, so, yeah, I,
well, this is
unfortunately,
the thing. Yeah, sorry, Joe. Well, this is the thing, Joey, you know, as you are a proud advocate for the LGBTQI plus community, you know, who advocate a lot on behalf of the ladies in Tonga, what then do you think is the sort of reaction you're expecting from maybe Tonga's government about this news?
Well, again, I haven't heard anything from any of my, even from my from my own district representative, hey, nothing. I haven't heard anything from them, and or even the people from the government that I actually know. They haven't said anything at all. I think they've got bigger problems to deal with, you know. But because what's going on now is we've actually translated the UN SOGIE's guideline, and that was asked by the Lord Speaker to actually translate it into Tongan language, and that we've been requested to actually take that to all the districts, eh, in Tonga, and educate our people about the different genders and all that. And yeah, it's been very, very good, the response. There hasn't been any backlash on anything like that. We're even working with some of the ministries to actually adopt that language into, you know, the Family Protection Act and all that. So, I think with our government, I think they're more worried about all these American ban and all that. But to be honest, I haven't really heard anything at all until maybe when I get back home this weekend.
Yes.
I will know more about, you know, if there's anything at all. But there hasn't been any, even when I was listening to the radio, I was tuning into Radio A3Z yesterday, and even to the radio, to all the other radio broadcasting commissions,
Yeah, so it seems like a bit of a breaking news then for our community. Joey, that's all the time we have. And I do really appreciate you coming on the show this morning. It's probably a conversation that needs to continue to be had. We just want to say mālo pito for your time this morning.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
No worries. That, of course, is Joey Jolene Mataele, Executive Director of the Tonga Ladies Association here on Pacific Beat. Well, Fiji's police chief says they've completed their analysis of a commission of inquiry report into the appointment of the country's anti-corruption commissioner and have handed their findings to the Prime Minister. The report, which has yet to be made public, has caused political upheaval in Fiji, resulting in the sacking of Barbara Malimali as the head of the Independent Commission Against Corruption and Attorney General Graham Leong. Police Commissioner Rusiate Tinduravu says the report had been referred to the police by the PM and now they're awaiting further guidance on it.
And I can confirm that analysis has been completed and the findings are submitted to the Office of the Prime Minister. We are awaiting further guidance on the matter. And in the meantime, a team of senior investigators from the Criminal Investigation Department has been formed to await further guidance from my office. Once further guidance is received, I have given specific instructions to the team to solely focus on this investigation as it is a national case of interest and provide progress of investigation through the line Assistant Commissioner of Police Crime. And I want to stress the independence of investigation process, as a lot has been said by certain individuals about the alleged findings of the inquiry, that some feel would prejudice the investigations. The investigation team will begin their work by gathering information before conducting interviews with persons of interest who will be identified during the course of investigation. The team assigned to conduct investigation are senior investigators who have on their own merit investigated many major cases of national interest, and I urge members of the public to trust the process.
And that's Fiji Police Commissioner Rusiate Tinduravu. Again, Noia, welcome back to Pacific Beat to Sport now. Auckland City FC may be the best club in the Oceania Football Club Confederation, but this week they're facing the best teams in the world. And it didn't take long for Bayern Munich, the German football giant, to demolish the Auckland side 10-0. The loss means Auckland City FC will have to win its next pool matches to progress. So joining us this morning to chat about all the action at the FIFA Club World Cup is Matt Brown from the OFC. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this morning. I must say, tough start for Auckland City FC, yeah? But who is next in line for the team to face, you know, in order to progress further in the Club World Cup?
Well, they've got a really tough group. I mean, Group C has obviously Bayern Munich, and that was a brutal welcome to the tournament, you know, against the likes of, you know, Harry Kane and Musiala and, you know, literally Joshua Kimmich. I mean, the Germans played arguably, you know, their strongest lineup. It was incredible. It showed respect to Auckland City, but clearly they are, you know, a class above, ranked in the top five club sides in the planet, and Auckland probably ranked around 4,000. So it was always going to be, you know, a really tough ask to compete. And it gets probably, you'd argue, slightly easier. They played Benfica, but Benfica are on Saturday morning, they are a Portuguese, one of the top three sides in Portugal, along with Porto and Sporting Lisbon. And you know, they are a class act as well and a powerful European side. So it's going to be difficult again. And then their final group match is against, you know, one of the best in South America in Boca Juniors. So from Argentina. So, yeah, it is, you know, you could argue that they got drawn in the group of death, which hasn't helped in the sense you've got three really competitive sides. And, you know, if I look at some of the other groups, you know, there are teams in the competition which you think, well, they would be competitive against, without a doubt. We've seen that with Auckland City at Club World Cups in the old format, where they'd gone up to the Middle East to play. And, you know, in one year, in fact, 2014, they got third, their best place at the tournament. And they certainly didn't have 10-0 thrashings. So it's a little bit unfortunate with the draw. But also I think the circumstances, you know, this Auckland City side, probably not as strong as sides in the past. Some of their best players, are two in particular, I think, From last year, for example, their captain Cam Howison and also Liam Gillian both signed for Auckland FC to play in the A-League. And of course, we know what happened to that team. They went on to win the Premier Plate and have an incredible season as a fully professional team. You've got to remember the Auckland City side of amateurs, the only amateur side in the tournament. They all work, train two or three times a week, but you know, that's not what's earning them the money. So a lot of circumstances to take into account.
Yeah, look, before we even sort of get into the performance of Auckland City FC, I understand there's been a bit of confusion though online as to which Auckland team actually played, because I think with some thinking it was Auckland FC, the A-League team that took on Bayern Munich, is that right?
Absolutely. A lot of social media chatter about it. People thinking it was Auckland FC compared to Auckland City. Now, the two stadiums are probably, 10, 12 kilometres apart in Auckland. Auckland City's ground holds about 2,000 at a pinch. They probably average 500 at a game. And, of course, Auckland FC holds 25,000 and they averaged 18,000 this season in their first season. The two club emblems are reasonably similar, and I know it caused some consternation with Auckland City, who had originally bid to be part of the A-League, but with the consortium coming in backed by the billionaire of Bill Foley, obviously the A-League looked at the money that was on offer there and went in that direction, and they were quite strategic in terms of, I think, the design. They attracted, probably a lot of fair weather fans who may have supported Auckland City in the past. So, there is the fact is, though, one club is professional, and I still believe Bayern Munich would have beaten Auckland FC comfortably. Maybe not 10, but certainly, you cannot compare the two clubs. Chalk and cheese when Bayern Munich play Auckland City, it was always going to be an issue. And I think it's one of the reasons, if you look at this expanded club World Cup, 32 teams, and why OFC is launching a professional league next year. And from next year, so for the next edition of the Club World Cup in 4 years' time, Auckland City won't actually be eligible, even if they win the OFC Champions League, which is an amateur competition. The team that competes from Oceania at the Club World Cup will be a team that's been playing professional football for four seasons, launches in January and goes through to May, the inaugural OFC Professional League. So that will be a little bit of a game changer in the sense that you'll have clubs, playing at a higher standard and full-time professionals. So it's part of the plan, to have OFC teams being more competitive on the international stage.
Yeah, well, let's talk about, much has been said about how Auckland City FC is made up of players, right, who work for a living and then they play football literally because of passion, while the competition are professional players. Does that make a big difference?
It makes a massive difference. You've got plumbers, you've got welders, you've got a barman, you've got storemen, the goalkeeper is a storeman at a supermarket and literally, goes to training after work and trains a couple of times a week. Yeah, they've got a physio, they've got resources. For an amateur club, they've got good resources, but it does not compare to what professional footballers have. All around the world, if you're in a professional environment where you've got literally on-call access to, to dietitians, to physios, to doctors, trainers, you have individual plans. You are living and breathing football. And so if you're a talent, your skills are being harnessed to the absolute maximum potential. Whereas when you're an amateur and you're, training a couple of hours, a couple of times a week and then playing a game on Saturday, it's very different. And I'm sure many people listening who are amateur footballers or amateur rugby players or, who are listening as sports players, the difference is so stark and it makes a massive difference. And can't emphasise that enough. So, what Auckland City have achieved, and they deserve, for me, they still deserve to be at the Club World Cup because this, they have been the best team in Oceania for a long, long time. They've won 13 OFC Champions League titles. They've been very consistent for an amateur level. They are, the very best. So what that shows you when they come up against Bayern Munich, who go and put 10 past them, and, Bayern Munich, some people would say, maybe Bayern Munich Munich will go a bit easy on them, but no, they're a professional club. There's millions and millions of dollars on offer at this tournament too. You know, they're going to be ruthless, and they were ruthless. And but what an experience. The other side to look at, I think, is the experience that these players, you know, it's a chance of a lifetime for them. These players who've you know, committed so much and sacrificed a lot, you know, taking annual leave to be at this tournament for a month, for example. It's a huge honor for them and a thrill. And you know, I believe they'll be more competitive. They will play even better in the next two matches. I certainly hope so. But yeah, you're always going to get the critics. You're going to get the naysayers coming out saying, you know, oh, they shouldn't be there. But there's a lot of people who perhaps don't really understand, you know, the circumstances. You know, if we can clear that up a little bit,
yeah, that would absolutely. Oh, look, Matt, sorry, that is all the time that we have for this morning. But look, all the best again for Auckland City FC. But appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks very much.
And that is Matt Brown from the Oceania Football Confederation here on Pacific Beat.
State of Origin Footy is here on Radio Australia.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's hammer time!
Every try.
He pinned the ears back and he dives over to score in the corner.
And tackle.
What a tackle!
The State of Origin series between New South Wales and Queensland.
Giant set bingo!
Hear it live and ad-free.
Bing, bing, bing!
Wednesday, 7 p.m. PNG time on Radio Australia. Your home of rugby league in the Pacific.
And that literally brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Remember to find our top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia, though, because your news is next. And coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. Until then, kia manea te ora. Have a great day. O tō awhātou. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories that connect us across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that continues that tradition, bringing you deep and personal stories from a diverse range of people. Athletes, farmers, artists, teachers, activists, entrepreneurs, all united by their Pacific heritage and incredible journeys.
Listen to Stories from the Pacific on your favorite podcast app.